American author and journalist Christopher Caldwell believes Europe is facing one of its biggest challenges in centuries. His new book, Reflections on the Revolution in Europe, Immigration, Islam and the West, argues that immigration from Islamic countries is placing enormous social, political and economic strain on secular European nations. And he warns that what lies ahead is turmoil and potentially conflict. Christopher Caldwell is the senior editor of the conservative Weekly Standard magazine, and he writes for the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post and the Atlantic Monthly. And he's been reporting on the politics and culture of Islam in Europe for more than a decade. When he spoke with the book show's Verica Jokic, Christopher Caldwell began by explaining the reference to revolution in his book's title.
You know, in the United States, we had a huge demographic change between roughly the middle of the 19th century and the 1920s. When we changed from being a country that was pretty secure in its identity as an offshoot of Great Britain to a country that received just mass immigration year after year. And by the end of that period, the United States was a very different country. And it's become a commonplace to refer to that as a revolution in the demographics of the United States and in the country's self-understanding. I would say that the same term would apply just as well to what Europe is going through now.
Where does the bulk of immigration into Europe come from?
Well, this chapter in Europe's story, I would say, started in the aftermath of World War II. What you had was a continent that was largely destroyed physically, but also destroyed morally, in need of rebuilding its institutions, and gravely short of manpower. So emergency measures were taken to fill the gap in manpower. Countries that had empires, such as Britain and the Netherlands and France, tended to import labor from their old colonial possessions. Countries that didn't have empires tended to sign bilateral agreements with poorer countries. And that's what Germany did, starting in the 1950s with Southern Europe and generally moving to Turkey. Over time, that has changed. And Europe's source of Europe's population influx has become more varied. And this is an example of a phenomenon that I describe in the book. Once you open the door to mass immigration, it becomes very hard to close. And this is not anyone's fault, and it's not the result of any conspiracy or bad planning or anything. It's just the way things tend to happen.
To what extent has Europe brought on this labour shortage on itself with a declining birth rate? And the reason why I also bring that up is because the OECD says Italy, for example, will lose 28% of its population by 2050 and will need to start importing 350,000 immigrants per year or keep its citizens working until they are 75. Now, that seems like an extraordinary amount of people that Italy will need to keep Italy looking like Italy, in your words.
This is a much more recent phenomenon. You know, Europe had a baby boom in the aftermath of World War II, just as the United States and Australia did. But now birth rates are declining precipitously. Europeans are very reluctant to talk about this because discussion of declining birth rates has in the past gone along with discussion of eugenics and that sort of thing. It's a subject that has a very, very checkered past in Europe. But it is a huge fact staring Europeans in the face. So it's certain that Europe's population is going to decline.
So therefore, isn't immigration a good solution to Europe?
It is, in a very limited way. If your goal is to keep your country and your workforce the same size, then it does help. And I took the example in my book of Italy. You know, one of the things that's really charming about Italy is what you, to be blunt about it, you could call its inefficiency. You know, you have gardeners hand-tending parks, and you have hand-picked vegetables, and you have handicrafts. Italy is soon not going to have the manpower to live that Italian way of life. So they're going to have the choice between two things, either to mechanize or to import labor, which means either Italy's get to choose between a less Italian way of life and a less Italian population. But I should really add that there's a limit to how much imported labor of this sort can be a solution to the problems that Europe faces. And one of the things that a declining population does is it makes a generous social welfare state of the sort that a lot of Europeans think of as sort of synonymous with their constitution. It makes that less possible because you have fewer laborers supporting more retired people. And bringing in immigrant labor does not solve that problem.
Doesn't it solve it to a certain extent, though?
Yes, it does temporarily. It does temporarily, but these workers themselves will retire. And generally, the jobs that immigrants, at least in Europe, are brought in to do pay less than the median wage, so they generate less in tax revenue. I think in a kind of bizarre way, the American system, its lack of generosity makes immigration a little bit easier to handle in two ways. One is that I think that the workplace is the main place that immigrants turn into natives. It's the main place they assimilate. And so they have to be in the workplace. And in the United States, the idea of an unemployed first generation immigrant is almost an oxymoron. You just don't see them the way you do all over European cities. So that helps in one way, and it helps in a second way.
And by natives, you mean?
I mean the people of the native culture born in the country that is receiving the immigrants, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it helps in a second way by, I think, probably improving the attitudes of natives to immigrants.
One of the other things that you look at in terms of the problems or the lack of willingness to assimilate tend to be very Western problems. You've got rampant consumerism, hedonism, binge drinking, drug taking, body piercings, gambling, high divorce rates, and so forth. Now, if you're an immigrant who comes from a traditional culture where these sorts of things don't exist, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a Western European country where all these things are around you, is it not surprising then that people reject that?
This is one of the key points in my book, and this is where Islam comes into it most specifically. You know, I think that I've written a very pessimistic book about immigration in Europe, and because of that, a lot of people will leap to the conclusion that I take a dim view of Islam. In fact, part of the reason I'm pessimistic about integration and assimilation is that I think that under the circumstances in which most immigrants are coming to Europe now, the traditional cultures of their parents look like a pretty appealing alternative to the sort of atomized, drifting, valueless cultures of Europe, which are okay if you can afford to buy things for yourself and if you're living at the top of the European lifestyle. If you're poor and you're in need of support, I don't think the European lifestyle looks so appealing. And I think that a lot of the people who profess themselves optimists about European immigration are basically assuming that it's absolutely automatic that people from these other cultures are going to totally throw over everything they've learned thus far, or what they've learned from their immigrant parents, and adopt European values wholesale. And I don't think there's anything inevitable about it.
Well, sticking on the theme of pessimism, you talk about violence, and on page 17 of your book you write, immigrants also bring a lot of disorder and crime. Turkish immigrants have been responsible for shootouts in schools in France and the Netherlands. How many shootings are we talking about? Because I wonder why you didn't at this point in your book also point out that some of the deadliest school shootings in Europe have been carried out by non-immigrants. There was one earlier in Germany this year where a 17-year-old German called Tim Kretschmer went on a killing rampage. He killed 16 people. In September last year in Finland, Martti Saari walked into a school and shot dead 11 people, including himself. The previous year in Finland as well, in 2007, another Finnish person killed 9 people. And then I think it was in 1996 in Scotland in Dunblane, Thomas Hamilton killed 16 5- and 6-year-old children and their teachers. So why make the distinction about Turkish immigrants being responsible for a lot of crime without counterbalancing that with the fact that it's non-immigrants have actually committed some of the most horrendous crimes?
You should not read that passage as an implication that European natives don't commit crime on their own. There is in general, though, in most European countries, the crime rate among in immigrant communities is higher than the crime rate among the native born. That's just in the very introduction of the book, and it's a way of laying out one of the things that Europeans complain about when they complain about immigration.
When I read that I thought, you know, as a journalist, I found a little bit disconcerting that you are also a journalist and you make these statements, but you don't actually back it up with statistics or you don't source it. So to me, that was a weakness in your argument.
Yeah, I think that I actually did cite statistics about prison populations in France, in Sweden, and in Italy. And there are fairly good numbers available on these, where you do have a disproportionately large immigrant population among the prisoners.
Let's look at France. Now, you spend, in your book, you spend a lot of time talking about two countries in particular, France and Denmark. What are the problems with immigration as you see them in France?
France is a very interesting case. Of all the countries in Europe, it's France that both, in terms of lip service and in terms of reality, most the kind of place that where you can belong to the country just by feeling French and not by being French. It is a real republic of values. And I think that France, more than other countries, has an ethic that says you can become just as French as I am if you, if you live here and you follow the laws, etc.
But that doesn't necessarily work in some of the areas where a lot of these immigrants are moved to as soon as they come to France. You know, they seem to be shunted away to these horrible areas on the outskirts of Paris or outskirts of some of the other major cities. They live in these towering high-rises in public housing buildings. And in an environment where there's a lot of unemployment, where there's a lot of disillusionment, quite a few social problems. So if you and there's anger and isolation. So if you live in one of those areas, how can you feel French?
Right. I do want to say before I continue on this, one of the really surprising things that you find if you look at surveys of immigrant attitudes and second generation attitudes is that of the major countries in Western Europe, it's France's immigrants and second-generation kids who have the most feeling of belonging in their country. Now, the problems you describe are, you're absolutely right about that. There are certain countries that have been very fortunate in their urban architecture and certain countries that have been less fortunate or have made mistakes. France and Sweden stand out for having overbuilt public housing, particularly in the 1960s. They have a vast stock of public housing, far removed, not just from cities, but also from public transportation. And it has become very tempting to park immigrants in these undesirable houses.
Tempting because it's cheap?
Tempting because they're often lying empty, you know, because the natives don't like them. If you're receiving refugees or asylum applicants at a huge rate, and Sweden was, you know, a country of 9 million, was receiving almost 100,000 of them in the early 90s. You need a place to put these people. So it's understandable how immigrants wound up in these segregated areas, but it is, as you say, an explosive mix.
One of the things that you do talk about, I think it's on page 109 of your book, you write, it wasn't that the young Muslims were assimilating too slowly in European culture as the generations passed. It was that they were disassimilating.
Yeah, this is a problem, and this is one thing that has, I think, changed since immigrants began coming in the 1950s. There were certain things certain institutions that were not present and that have appeared since then and have sort of complicated the job of assimilating them. One is, I believe the mass media has a different effect on immigration than it used to. In the old days, you know, where you had national television stations and very little choice of programming, what immigrants saw on TV tended to confirm them in the national culture. They would learn English and French jokes. They'd get the news that their native-born neighbors would get. Now, thanks to the internet and satellite television, they can watch the news from their home country. It keeps their hearts and minds in their home country. A lot of the tension, I think, in the French banlieue that you've mentioned comes from the rise of Islam abroad and of its claims. I think that the geopolitical situation in which Muslims, not just in Europe, but all over the world, tend to sort of identify with the Palestinian cause, for instance, that has really, really complicated matters in Europe. It's led to a lot of violence in Europe. It's led to a lot of anti-Semitic attacks in France. And when France was devising its immigration policies in the 1950s and the 1960s, that was really nowhere on the horizon. People were not looking at the question in that sense. And in fact, neither Islam, neither fundamentalist Islam, nor the sort of international identification of Arabs with other Arab countries, neither of those was really on the table or on the horizon. A lot of these things are accidents.
There seems to be, from reading your book, a lot of distrust and animosity towards immigrants, particularly Islamic immigrants.
Whose part?
Of the people who are non-immigrants, natives in your language. I wonder, if you pare it down to the bare bones, is this a case of secular Europe having an aversion to religion in general or specifically to Islam?
That's a very good question, and it's a tough one to answer. Traditionally, Europe's traditional intolerance for Islam has been a religious-based one. I mean, over the years when Islam was considered a main enemy of Europe, it was by Christians. Today, I would say that relations between religious Christians and religious Muslims are actually really surprisingly good. If you look at these same surveys of immigrant attitudes that I've mentioned, you find that Muslims, particularly young Muslims, have a very, very positive attitude towards Christianity. I think that a lot of the tension between Europe and its new immigrants comes from non-religious Europeans, those who have developed a new, more secular ideology. And a curious thing is that, you know, we read a lot about terrorism, and I really don't think that in most European countries, I think Britain might be an exception, but in most European countries, it's not anything geostrategic, or it's not these questions of terrorism that really bother people. I think the thing that bothers people most about immigration in general and Muslim immigration very much in particular is that they see it as a threat to feminism. Whenever you have people agitating against immigrant ways of life, it's most often got to do with immigrant family structures. The arranged marriages, honor killings in Sweden and Denmark, female circumcision, the veil. I think that it's the traditional Muslim attitude towards women that I think is the real sticking point for a lot of Europeans. And that's not a religious matter, because I think that it's not always so far from the traditional Christian attitude towards women.
Christopher Caldwell speaking with Verica Jokic about his book Reflections on the Revolution in Europe, Immigration, Islam and the West. It's published by Penguin.